chill? Are you wearing a kimono? Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Suddaby, and I'm here with my co-host, Shel McDonald. We are two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Hey, Alan.
Hi. I really just like raced right through it.
Yeah, it's good.
I didn't even ask you how you were.
So. Well, I'm doing okay.
Oh, good.
I was actually a little tired this morning. I'm not quite sure what happened there, but it's not like I didn't sleep well last night, but when I woke up.
But when you woke up, your pillowcase was threadbare.
Pretty much. Yeah.
I had a random piece of follow-up from way, way in the past.
Oh, cool.
Do you remember like a big piece of our conversation about steel wheels was the graffiti and how it's like an interesting way that the guests interact with the space and like claim ownership of the space and stuff like that. And we were maybe trying to think of other places that are similar.
Right.
And I don't think we had much in Edmonton, but I recently ate at Gravy. Do you know Gravy Burger and Fries?
Have heard of it, but I have not eaten there. Is it, it used to be the
local omnivore. Sorry.
Local omnivore.
Yeah, correct. That's right.
Right. Yeah.
So they have one wall in that space was like painted white, and I think it has the Gravy logo in the middle, but it's intentionally been set aside for customer graffiti, and
cool.
They're working on it. It's not full yet, and it doesn't have the same effect as steel wheels, but there it is.
But maybe eventually.
Someday. Yeah.
I wonder if they were inspired by steel wheels to do that.
Maybe.
They seem like the type of people who would be inspired by steel wheels to do that.
Yes.
Be shocked if they hadn't spent some time at steel wheels.
Yeah. They do. They have that place has a White Avenue vibe to it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's misplaced in Queen Mary Park? It's kind of
sure.
By you.
Oh, yeah. I guess it is in Queen Mary Park. It's pretty close to where I live, actually. It's like,
yeah, totally. Yeah. Check it out. Good, good burgers, good little smash patties, and yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, right on. I did enjoy it when it was local omnivore, but it was also like a little too epic for me or something. I don't know.
How so?
Epic in the sense of like epic mealtime.
Oh, is there like a little bit over the top?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it was like over the top, kind of like diner food, and their breakfast there. They had some pretty intense stuff on the menu. And I went there twice, I think, and both times when I went there, I ordered something, and then I was like, oh my God, there's no way I can eat all this. And
right.
And it's like too big and too rich.
I never ate there when it was the local omnivore. And I think that I always had kind of assumptions about it because of its name. Like it just sounded like a quaint farm to table kind of spot because of that name.
I definitely agree. And I had heard, and I'd met a couple of the guys who run it at like food events, and the food that they always had at events was very much that sort of like over the top kind of like diner food style situation, a little bit diner, a little bit Joe Beef or something.
Right. Yeah.
And so I sort of understood that that was the kind of food that they were doing, but I could never really reconcile it with the name.
Right.
And maybe that was part of, seemingly eventually they had to, you know, rebrand the restaurant and maybe change the concept. And so, maybe that was part of the problem. I don't know.
Well, Gravy is
Gravy's perfect for that.
An excellent name and brand for that style of food.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I don't think I really have much follow-up. So it's time for topics, Alan.
Yeah. And it's is the title of this one The Smallest Book Club in the World?
Where oh, sure.
I'm just kidding.
Do you want me to change it right now? Right now, the title is Book Report. It sounds really boring.
Well, that's good, too. That's more what it's like.
Can I call it the littlest?
The littlest book club.
Book club. How about just the littlest book club?
Just like mathematically, it's the smallest book club that you could have.
Yeah, exactly.
Besides the null book club, the null set book club. But
null set book club. Yeah, exactly. Where no one reads, where there are no members and no books are read.
Just a little math joke for you out there. What we were going to talk about is I have, I actually don't read very much anymore. Like during the school year, I read almost nothing except what is absolutely essential for my job.
Right.
But in the summer, because I have a pretty luxurious summer break when classes are out, that's my reading season.
Yeah, and I believe they call those beach reads or summer reads, Alan.
Totally, yeah. Except that to me, that implies that it's like not serious reading. Like a beach read is like a Dan Brown novel, right?
We're going to talk about serious reading?
Oh, yeah, big time.
Oh, wow.
In terms of food,
what's writing. An Alan Beach read then? I gotta wrap my head around this.
I don't get.
Can we just pretend that we both understand what I'm getting at when I say that what's an Alan Beach read? I know you're not going to the beach, Alan. I know you're probably reading it.
I went to Mamiyo last week.
What did you read when you were there, Dan Brown?
No, I read Heat by Bill Buford. Okay, hold on. Okay, so I've got 8 weeks of summer vacation, and I've set the task of reading one book a week. So I have 8 books. They're all food related, and I'm reading them. I'm halfway through week 4, so I've read 3 books, and I'm working on a 4th. And I wanted to tell you or talk to you about the books, and at least one of them, maybe 2 of them, you've read as well.
Sweet,
but we haven't really. We haven't worked out how we're going to talk about it, but the 3 books that I've finished are Medium Raw by Anthony Bourdain,
right.
Heat by Bill Buford, and Letters to a Young Chef by Danielle Boulud. And I'm working on Counterintelligence by Jonathan Gold, but I feel like that
one
is going to be a whole other thing that we'll talk about at a later date.
Totally.
So yeah, I'm going to give little book reports on those 3 books, and I think there are many several avenues of conversation for us to explore.
Sweet. Yeah, so out of those, I have read Medium Raw.
Oh yeah. Oh great.
Although it's been a really long time, and honestly I don't even remember too much about it. I guess it's sort of like a, if I'm remembering correctly, it's sort of like a less sensationalistic, more grounded follow-up to Kitchen Confidential. Is that sort of the vibe?
It was billed as the follow-up to Kitchen Confidential, although there's only one. It's a collection of essays, really. Only one of those deals directly with like actually following up with the content of Kitchen Confidential.
Gotcha.
Really, it's like a collection of the different pieces are not really related. They just have very disparate topics, but yeah, it's a collection.
Yeah, man, I don't really remember too much about it.
I'll jog your memory.
Yeah. And then I have also read Heat by Bill Buford. And am I correct in my, remembering correctly that I gave a book report about another Bill Buford book on this very show?
Yeah, you did. Dirt, right?
Dirt.
Which I didn't really appreciate, even though you mentioned it or made the allusion, like I didn't realize that it really is a direct follow-up to Heat. Like the last line, Heat is a very Italian and Italian-American focused book.
Right.
But like you mentioned when talking about Dirt, a lot of it, there's this kind of recurring idea of the I don't know if it's false history or the myth or whatever of Catherine de' Medici taking Italian cooking to France in the 16th century.
Right.
So just as that was part of Dirt, it was also part of Heat. And actually the last line of Heat is, I need to go to France or something like that. Like he's,
oh, okay.
in his exploration of this idea, like he's kind of explored Italian American cooking, gone to Italy, learn to make pasta, learn to butcher. And then he's like, I really need to go to France. And so in that way, Dirt is like a sequel almost, or yeah.
That's cool. It seems, because I read Heat like when? In the early 2000s, I guess.
I think it came out in 2006. So yeah, it was.
Oh, okay. So late 2000s, I guess. Then.
And by came out, I mean was published. I don't know why I said
was published.
Came out.
Yeah.
Movies come primarily, out, books are published.
Right. So I guess I must have read it like soon after it was published. And so that's been like a almost, I mean, because like I'm sure that the travel and the sort of research that he did for Heat all took place before the book was published. So, you know, maybe from, who knows, does he say in the book? I can't remember, like maybe from 2000 to 2004 or 2005, and then he wrote the book or something like that.
Right.
And then I guess Dirt came out a couple of years ago. So it's a long journey that he's been on, delving into this like idea about food history. I think if like, I don't know, I can picture a scenario wherein like he got this idea while he was like traveling in Italy and exploring Italian American food, that, you know, this would be a rich vein of like food history for him to dig into as like an author and a journalist. Mm-hmm. And then like, to come to the end of Dirt after like 20 years of digging into this, like trying to find evidence for this like connection that you think that some people have made or something, and coming out with absolutely no evidence.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be like a pretty rough journey? I feel like.
Is that, are you confident in the publication date of Dirt? Was it really only in the last few years?
I believe so. I'll look it up quickly. Hang on. Check.
But you're right. It's like a sizable portion of his life would have been devoted to the two works. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, seemingly he got, you know, enough out of it to publish two books. And so that's an accomplishment in and of itself.
Right.
But if his like idea was that he was going to uncover some like hidden knowledge about the history of French food, well, I think he probably wound up disappointing himself.
He's probably done lots of other things in the last time. Where, like,
oh,
funny,
I'm sure, yeah.
He's like,
aside from move his family from the U.S. to France and
right.
try to make a life there while writing a book, and also being trained as a French chef and mm-hmm. almost failing, I'm sure he had lots of room to do other stuff in there.
And he's someone like
publication date August 17th, 2020. So yeah.
Oh wow. Okay. Yeah. Recent. So very yeah. recent. Yeah. And he's someone who he's almost the flip of Bourdain, where it's like Bourdain was a chef for decades. And then, well, I mean, I think he probably wrote throughout his life, but really was only published later in his life. Whereas Bill Buford was like a career editor and writer. Like he wrote or he edited the New Yorker's fiction section for years and years before writing Heat. And so he went from writing to cooking. Whereas most of what we read is people who are cooks who start to write.
Yeah. Because they burnt their hands too much and they can't stand in front of a stove anymore.
Yeah.
And they're like, now what am I going to do?
so yeah, so of those three books, I we'll talk about them individually, I guess. But like, to me, Medium Raw and Heat together, they like kind of, I had a lot of feels mm-hmm. reading them, because they're from the same era. Like they were published within a few years of each other, and they were both published right around when I was starting to cook professionally.
Right.
And they're both actually, they're both kind of, well, they're both by New Yorkers. And I traveled to New York right around this time when they were published. And so I know all of the chefs, the restaurants, the food writers that they're talking about. And like, for instance, like David Chang, like one of the pieces
right.
in, Medium Raw is just about David Chang, because it's 2010. He's just been named like the James Beard, you know, best new chef. And my coworkers are like bringing copies of the Momofuku cookbook to work. And when I go to New York, I know I need to go to Mafuku or Ko or whatever, and
right
stuff like that. Like he's a big deal. It was a really big big part of the New York scene then. So there was that element. It was kind of like nostalgia for that. It's not so long ago, but that time.
Yeah, 13 and like very ago. Specific nostalgia, sort of like for your kind of your food journey, I guess, yep. Or something like that.
Yeah, totally. And then there was also this element, of course, where like so now. 15 or 20 years have passed and a lot has changed. Like for instance, Anthony Bourdain is dead. Right. And Mario Batali is no longer a part of the Batali and Bastianich hospitality group. And is all these, like sexual harassment and abuse claims that he's settled out of court. And, so yeah, it was an interesting, they were interesting reads for that reason. Like on the one hand, the really keen nostalgia, and then also like thinking back on how much has changed and seeing, especially with Bourdain, like knowing that he committed suicide and then going back and reading, like there's loads of stuff about his depression and outright like feeling suicidal in Medium Raw. And so it was really poignant, I guess, in that way.
Yeah. I haven't really like, since Anthony Bourdain's suicide, I haven't really gone back and reread any of the books of his that I read when I was, early in my career.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly remember them, you know, being full of like pretty personal observations that made it seem like, you know, he was not always having a great time, that he right. was, you know, that things were like that he felt pretty rough.
Yes.
A lot of the time. And I mean, some of that, I think that there was definitely, and in Kitchen Confidential, I think like as much as there was sort of like this kind of sense of belonging, I feel like there was also like a lot of imposter syndrome or something.
Oh, yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's actually especially the first few pieces in Medium Raw, I would say that's almost, even when ostensibly it's, say the, I think it's the first piece in Medium Raw is about him being invited to this clandestine dinner to eat ortolan. Like the we've talked about a few times, the songbird, the famously endangered songbird that is like supposed to be this gastronomic delight that like from traditional French cooking, he's invited to try it, this kind of secret meeting with other chefs. And so on the surface, that's what the
it's piece a secret is about. Meeting about eating birds where you have to secretly put a towel over your head.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. and so on the surface, that's the plot or whatever of the piece. Is that like that's what's happening? Right. But really, the theme of the piece is that he feels he doesn't even belong there because he's looking around the room and everybody is nameless. Like it's all confidential because what they're doing is illegal apparently.
Right.
So he doesn't name names, but he's like, these are actual real accomplished chefs. I am a hack cook.
And I'm just a guy who started a restaurant on the back of a book that I wrote and I'm not even very good or something.
Yeah. And there's a few of the pieces early in Medium Raw. That's what they're about. It's like him dealing with like wondering if he's a sellout or knowing that he's a sellout and grappling with that. It's all, to be honest, it's almost, it's all very valid, but it's almost annoying. Like, it's like, yeah, but we're here to listen to you and we want to like, yeah. We like your voice and we want to hear what you have to say about what we're exploring. But in some, there's some times where that element of it is just like, okay, I get it. Let's
overpowering. Yeah.
Yeah. It's detracting from, or even confusing sometimes where it's like, really, we're here to learn about the ortolan or like to hear about what the experience was. And there's definitely, you're right. I remember it's always been a part of what of the story he's telling where like, for instance, yes, there's like all these zany tales in Kitchen Confidential about partying and drug use and all that. But knowing that he was not sober, but like that he wasn't like he had given up heroin and cocaine by the time he was writing these books. But he always mentions this kind of like he thought that when he gave that stuff up, that his life would suddenly be easier,
right.
Or that he would feel a lot better about himself. but it was still very difficult for him. It was like he gave it up and he didn't have those good times, but he also just felt like everything was very difficult still. And so he was always something that was kind of balancing in the back of his mind. Like, so yeah, there's some really one piece in particular. I think it's called The Rich Eat Differently Than You and Me or something in that vein.
Okay.
It's either during or immediately after his divorce from his first wife, and he's vacationing by himself in the Caribbean and like waking up and just drinking and mm-hmm. talking about, you know, driving around whatever island he's on in a Jeep and just like nightly wondering if he should drive it off a cliff kind of thing. So the descriptions like that were pretty jarring. Like, it's really hard to, you know, to read those things and know what happened to him and how it all worked out. But
It's pretty like it's, I mean, I think that, yeah, going back and reading that would be difficult, you know, like mm-hmm. it would be difficult to get through some of those passages knowing that, you know, he eventually did wind up committing suicide. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like, it's, I don't know, that's sort of like the core of what made his writing compelling, was just like the like self-effacing personal detail that he was, you know, that he felt comfortable sharing or incorporating into his work, like that, mm-hmm. that, you know, just that I think, you know, whether people are depressed or not, or suicidal or not, or just having a rough time, you know, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, exploring that and not just in like a, I don't know, perfunctory way, but like in a way that sort of was sort of like an ongoing analysis of it, you right. know, for himself, I think is what, you know, made a lot of his writing really compelling and, mm. and like relatable.
Yeah. And I wonder if there's an almost like a catch-22 element to it where, he says anyways, like when he wrote Kitchen Confidential, he didn't expect it to be so widely read. Like, he said he was writing it for, you know, the niche mm-hmm. crowd that understood the kitchen life. And then for it to be wildly successful, a New York Times bestseller, widely read. And then that became a core element of his writing, like to be so to tell it as it is and not pull punches. And yeah, it might've been very difficult for him to continue in that vein, because that's what people are expecting right. from his writing voice. But it means that he's constantly dredging up the past basically. And
yeah,
talking about addiction and like talking about even things that aren't as serious as that, but like trying to, you know, when he's talking about chefs or food writers, like to really try and lay it all bare. Sounds exhausting at the best of times and could have been quite troubling for someone with his past and his temperament.
Yeah, no kidding. I think I remember reading Medium Raw not quite being as like propulsive as reading Kitchen Confidential or Cook's Tour even for that matter. And yeah, I wonder if that's because like, you know, he felt like he needed to go back to that well because that's what people were expecting him to sort of talk about or write about or delve into. But maybe not quite feeling as like excited about having to do it or something. I wonder. Right.
The majority of the pieces though are kind of there. I don't think any of these were previously published. Like, they're not collections from magazine publications or anything. But that's mm-hmm. how they read. Like, it's like it could be the collected writings of a food correspondent for a magazine. Cause it'll be like, one is about that Hors de Lens experience. One is about, right. One is about, you know, shadowing the guy who butchers all the fish at Le Bernardin.
Yeah, I remember that.
I can't remember his name. Here it is. Sorry, Justo Tomas. So it was like a guy from the Dominican. And the story goes that he personally daily butchers the 700 pounds of fin fish that Le Bernardin brings it.
Wow.
So,
and then I guess Bourdain and Eric Repair became pretty good friends. I wonder if that was like before or after that.
Yeah, I don't know what the timeline is, but yeah, I think I've heard each of them describe the other as their best friend. So like some really interesting, just like deep dives into a niche part of the industry. Some of them are more like criticism or like kind of, there's one call, actually, this is a good callback to something we've talked about. One of mm-hmm. the essays is called Alan Rickman is a Douchebag. And
okay.
So in our...
You mean Rickman?
No, not Alan Rickman. Not to be confused with Alan Rickman.
With Alan Rickman. Because I've heard that about Alan Rickman as well.
But... Oh, is that right? Well, I don't know anything about him besides his performances.
The late Alan Rickman.
Yeah. So Alan Rickman is a famous UK actor, but Alan Rickman was a food correspondent for GQ magazine, or maybe still is. I don't know. And we've talked about him, but I didn't... It's hard for me to remember actually what I knew and what I didn't know at the time we were talking about this, but in our food movies discussion, Babette's Feast and Ratatouille, we also had a notable mentions or like notable scenes or something. We were trying to find out or remember what the best food scenes were in different movies. And one that we talked about was from HBO's show Tremé.
Right.
And there was this story of a chef from New Orleans, working in New York, and that a restaurant critic visited the restaurant she was working at, and he had just basically trashed the city of New Orleans in a piece in GQ magazine.
Right.
And this was shortly after Hurricane Katrina. So it seemed like especially like uncalled for and vicious. Yeah. And so in the show Tremé, this chef has the bartender prepare a Sazerac cocktail. And then she walks into the dining room and she throws it in his face. We talked about that. And it's just like, it's just a funny scene and it's fun to watch. But here are some things. First of all, that article was by Alan Rickman. It really was published in GQ magazine. So in the show, when she's reading from the magazine, it's a real article.
Mm-hmm.
The actor at the table is Alan Rickman.
Wow, really?
He's playing himself.
I'm not surprised to hear that because that's, I can't remember the name of the creator of Tremé, but they were also the creator of The Wire. And they,
right,
and it's yeah. really important to them to, yeah, you like try to find actors, excuse me, to try to find actors or people to write the shows that they're working on who like authentically are involved in the experience that he's trying to cover or whatever, which
right.
is, I find really interesting.
Okay. So Alan Rickman is playing himself. It's they're reading the real article that was published in GQ, but here's one thing I'm almost certainly did not know at the time. Anthony Bourdain wrote that scene.
Oh, wow.
And this piece in Medium Raw, Alan Rickman is a Douchebag. He hates Alan Rickman. Like the entire piece is basically like, it's basically it doesn't mention Tremé at all. And I don't know if this was well before the show was,
I'm sure it must have been quite a while before, but probably somebody looked at that piece and was like, hey Bourdain, do you want to come and write this scene?
It could be, I don't know.
Yeah.
The whole piece is like a backstory to that scene. And so, basically, the broad strokes timeline is that there was some event in Florida where it was just like in jest. It was like there was some kind of joke competition, and Anthony Bourdain nominated Alan Rickman as Douchebag of the Year or something like that. And I think wow. maybe there was like a video of this that got posted, and afterwards, Alan Rickman, GQ food correspondent, he went to Les Halles, like the restaurant that Bourdain had formerly worked at. Bourdain was no longer associated with the restaurant at all.
Okay.
He went there and he reviewed it and basically tore it to pieces in GQ.
Oh my God.
And now,
man,
this,
get over yourself.
Exactly. And then, and there were some, whatever, some low blows and pot shots at Bourdain, even though he wasn't actually at the restaurant anymore. And so this essay in Medium Raw is like a response to that. And first of all, Bourdain explains why he nominated Alan Rickman for Douchebag of the Year. And the main reason was that shortly after Hurricane Katrina, while the city is still reeling and rebuilding, Richmond wrote this piece in GQ that was just like, the entire food scene there is overblown. There's nothing good there. The city, and it kind of like, it's actually really weird to read now. Like it just seems like he's drawing up all of the stereotypes of the city, saying that they're all drunkards and libertines and, you know, they deserved, wow, like the hurricane was there to punish them for their sins, basically.
Oh my God.
I'm paraphrasing, but he insinuates that. So, and pretty ridiculous, I think, but, and so that's why Bourdain nominated him. That's what Bourdain had in mind.
Seems fair.
Yeah. But what's really interesting about it is like, okay, so now knowing that they had this, at least on the page, they had this animosity and this rivalry or whatever you want to call it. Like they're taking mm-hmm. shots back and forth. But then to know that Bourdain wrote a scene in a television show and then Richmond plays himself in that scene, it just seems like they're actually not, there's not really genuine bad blood between them, or at least they both live in this world where it's kind of good to have that. It sells magazines basically, or sells copies of your mm-hmm. book, to have that kind of tension.
Weird rivalry. Yeah. Although I guess like, does it sell magazines to initiate that by writing an article about New Orleans after Katrina where like, you basically call out the city for being shitty,
right? Like, yeah, that's... I don't know. It's still like it's very. I don't obviously know all of the, like, really what their relationship was like. It seems very complicated and maybe possibly, like I said, it might be mutually beneficial for them to overblow whatever kind of,
right. I mean, I wonder if like, because I feel like Bourdain never really had a problem with like talking up his beefs that he had with people.
No.
And I don't think that they were like fake to help like drum up right. drama, really. You know, right. like I think that he really felt that way.
Yes.
But I think that what happens a lot of the time in these like high profile beefs where, you know, like people who are like somewhat famous or notorious in their field have these like public battles Rouse, that yeah. everyone can sort of kind of see play out. When you're, it's actually like, you know, for food writing and like for high end cuisine in the United States, for instance, and especially if it seems like both of them were kind of like East Coast based, mm-hmm. they probably, you know, had occasion and opportunity to run into each other, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
And you know, that can be, if you have like a serious beef with someone, that can be like really awkward. And eventually what happens is somebody tries to put you in front of the other to try and come to some sort of right. reconciliation,
yes.
or something. And so I wonder if there's a story there as well about like how writing that scene and having Alan Richman play himself in it was like a part of them like coming to terms with totally. Each other or something
yeah,
like that.
I'm
really curious now. I'd love to go out on the internet and see if there's an essay about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the, speaking of his it's not even a beef really, but him like just being very open about who he despises. One of the most yeah. surprising.
Are you going to talk about vegans now, Alan?
Oh yeah. There's many rants about yeah. that. And sometimes it just ruins the structure of his pieces. Like he'll just go off on
yeah.
on a rant about some vegetarian that he had an argument with. But like,
I think it really is funny.
There's one piece called Go Ask Alice, and he just like destroys Alice Waters. Like he hates Alice Waters.
Oh, wow.
which was really surprising to me. But yeah, like pretty savage. Like just like is she even really a chef? Like get off your high horse kind of stuff. Like, yeah,
I mean, I don't know, it's a lot. There's a lot of like weird dichotomy in his writing, because like in a way, yeah, he despises anything fancy, mm-hmm. but in a way he's like projected himself into the world of fanciness, you know,
right? Or even like a big source of those kinds of those conundrums are his relationship with the Food Network, because he kind mm-hmm. of made a name for himself in Kitchen Confidential by by bashing the Food Network stars like Bobby Flay. But then of course a Cook's Tour started on Food Network, didn't it?
I don't remember actually. It may have. Yeah.
There's one, it might actually, I think it's called Selling Out, but one of the pieces, at least part of it is, it's about how, why he left or why he was made to leave the Food Network, to move from the Food Network to, the Travel Network.
Okay.
And this is another nice,
which then subsequently was bought by CNN. And then is that how he went?
Well, yeah. I think at some point, I can't remember the name of the parent company, but the Travel Network was bought by the parent company of the Food Network. So he okay. had this sense of like never really getting out from under getting out from the claws. But there's a nice parallel between Medium Raw and Heat in that they both, not in an extended way, but they both give little glimpses into the growth of the Food Network from this kind of niche cable television channel to the like crazy media empire
juggernaut
that it is now. Yeah. And so, yeah, Bourdain talks about like when a Cook's Tour was first floated, like it was going to be, I think originally it was going to be a book, but then they were going to do some filming while he was doing the touring and it would be this series on the Food Network. And at that point it was all just too good to be true for him. He didn't have any wild expectations about it. It was just like an excuse to travel and eat and have fun. And they would make this program about it. But then it started to become very serious and personal for him when he realized what he could accomplish on the show. And it got to a point where Ferran Adrià had invited him to come and film in the kitchens at El Bulli and like, right. They were going to sit down and have this meal and Fran would eat with him and explain the dishes and all that. And so he felt like that was really important work. But it was this time when the Food Network was growing and they had new executives. I can't remember the woman's name now, the new CEO, Gail something. But and it was just like they were not interested. They were looking at ratings and like it's kind of like...
Right.
Yeah, he can do an episode in Spain about eating baby eels and the ratings will be tiny. Or he could like do a kind of Guy Fieri thing and go to a barbecue joint in Kansas and the ratings will be 10 times that. And it costs a fraction to produce the ones abroad. And so, yeah, these economics and all that, like he talks about, it was a nice kind of behind the scenes look of like what's happening at networks like that. The parallel between that and Heat is that Mario Batali, most of Heat or more than half of Heat is kind of like an extended profile of Mario Batali, who was one of the early stars of the Food Network with Molto Mario and of course Iron Chef America. And there's a similar glimpse in one of the chapters of Heat about the very smart but maybe soulless people who are growing the Food Network and turning it from what you and I kind of grew up with, like the Alton Brown kind of original Good Eats era, to what it became, like with the live competition shows and black box challenges and stuff like that.
Right.
I
find it so weird because like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't find this weird, but like, it's so funny because like the era that you're talking about, the Good Eats era or something, like, yeah, it was like all I wanted to watch. And then once it started to change to become more, I don't know, I guess like
lurid.
Yeah. Low brow, like, you know, attractive to a wider demographic, you know, it just became less compelling to me. And when I first started watching it, I was not a chef. Nope. And in fact, it like had, I mean, I was interested in food and I had worked in restaurants before, but I wasn't even cooking at the time. And it wasn't even on my radar in terms of something that I wanted to do. I was still interested in food though. And I liked to cook at home at that time. And so I loved watching the Food Network because I could, you know, watch somebody prepare something and then like go and prepare that thing. But then once those shows started to wind down and it became, all about like, oh man, what was that cooking competition show where you could like, everyone had a certain amount of money and you could buy like a handicap for your competitor. Like you could select something like, oh, they're not allowed to cut anything with a knife. They have to cut everything with a lid of a can or something like that. Really? Do you remember this?
That was a whole show, or that was like a
cook? Yeah, that was like a whole cooking game show, and I'm pretty sure it was on the Food Network. I can't remember what it was called now, and I can't remember who the hosts were either. But yeah, lurid is the way that I would describe it. And like, I just, you know, I could never, it was just always boring to me. Not just like, you know, like I was just like, oh, this isn't real, you know? Like, yes. This isn't somebody actually like doing something that's like, that they care about. This is just like, you know.
It's
trying to attract viewership. Yeah, it's spectacle. Yeah.
There's a really great, actually, I want to read you a short excerpt from Heat talking about the Food Network. And have we talked about Molto Mario on the podcast before or no?
Like about the show?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe briefly. It may have gotten a few mentions. I tend to personally try to stay away from talking about Mario Batali because I don't really want to, because I don't honestly know too much about the politics of what happened to him later in his career. I know enough to know that I don't really want to try to address it publicly because I don't really feel like I have anything that's you know, valid to say given the amount that I know about it. But but I think we have touched on Molto Mario a couple of times.
I distinctly remember we were talking about the movie Burnt, and I mentioned that Mario Batali was the consultant that did some of the food design for that, and we had a little discussion. I think you cut it out, but this is by talking about Heat by Bill Buford, I'm kind of stiff arming you. Like we have to talk about Mario Batali, but I mean, obviously I don't know that much about all of the sexual harassment and abuse charges. I know that many of them have been settled out of court. And stuff like that, but anyways,
lends them some validity, which is what makes
sad, absolutely, but, yeah. And not just so shortly after some of the allegations, like Batali, he gave up all of his ownership in Batali and Bastianich Hospitality, B&B Hospitality, but some of the claims have not only been settled like between Mario and individuals, but between Batali and Bastianich and former employees, which is like a pretty damning, like it's a damning admittance basically, like that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I think more than 20 employees.
Yeah. Not that I had any doubt.
Yeah.
Initially, but just that, it's kind of, it's just sad to see that, you know?
Yeah. And it like, I don't know, there's not much more to say about it, but like in Heat, it's interesting how like his, there are some very specific passages where that behavior by Batali, not assault or anything, but there is some pretty explicit sexual harassment described in detail in Heat.
Right.
And you could
probably, I don't really remember that.
Well, it's
you
things
can refresh
like,
my memory about it.
Sure. And I don't think there's very much commentary on it from Buford, but it is described very specifically. Like, for instance, in the last chapter, there's like basically Batali, you know, joking, quote unquote, that a waitress should remove her blouse for a customer.
Oh,
like to saying that to her, and haha, it's a joke. But in hindsight, like reading things like that, it's like, okay, this is disgusting. Like I can't. Yeah. And like I said, there's no comment on it from the author besides its pretty specific description. So I don't know what the intent was, if it's like, if Buford is presenting it as like, oh, look at this zany, this party guy who likes to.
Right. Or whether he's trying to shine a light on it without actually having to stick his nose in it or something. But
Anyways, food network. There's a good passage about the evolution of the Food Network from the chapter in Heat that's about Batali's role in those early days of the network. And so it goes, Molto Mario is now openly talked about as, quote, old-fashioned, an example of the, quote, how to stand and stir format, according to Judy Girard. who was put in charge in 2000 and ran the network during its first financially successful years.
Oh my God.
And so this is a quote from Judy. She says, "The format relies on the information being more interesting than the presentation, with a chef behind a stove, like a newscaster behind a desk." And to me, that, like, of all the things in both Medium Raw and Heat, that that the description of this old-fashioned idea that the information is more important than
the presentation.
How it's presented. That just says it all.
That, like, really hits the nail right on the head.
And not even,
like,
just
obviously,
for the
like, she's a very smart person who has this whole situation figured out and is just, like, really understands that she needs to be on the other side of it if money is what's important.
Yes.
Like, and it's just...
And it's so, like I said, not just, like, it... In the context of the Food Network, I'm like, oh my God, yes, that is exactly what has happened. But it's a whole, like, you know, looking back at this from 2023, the whole idea of post-truth and like going through the Trump era and stuff. It's like, yes, this is what this is the world. Like, it's not the Food Network. It's the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with that, Alan. My brain's broken now. And
welcome to Food Court.
that's a really terrifying observation you've made.
Yeah, man. I'll hold the book. Like, I put a little sticky note in that page of the book because I was like, this is the most important passage of the entire book.
Oh my God. I can picture, you know, like I can picture, you know, when you read a passage like that, that has an effect like that on you, that like spirals you out into thinking about something that's completely unrelated, but that is like obviously like very important to you personally, or something that's like a really big concept in your life that you've been thinking about, like sort of having a bit of an epiphany while reading something and then being like, oh my God, like this thing that this author just said just like really just smacked me in the face.
Yeah.
I know that feeling. Yeah. And I'll bet I had that feeling a lot while I was reading that book, but it was about dumb stuff about like standing and stirring probably.
That, I mean, because we're there, like, so Heat by Bill Buford, it has a really obnoxiously long subtitle. What is it? An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante quoting butcher in Tuscany.
Jeepers.
Really obnoxious subtitle. The structure of the book is, so Bill, as we mentioned already, he's like a career writer and editor, worked for The New Yorker for many years. And he decides that he's going to just quit his job, and go and work in the kitchens at Babo, which is the Batalion Bastianich kind of flagship restaurant. It's not really authentic Italian, but it's much more true to traditional Italian than most, American restaurants would have been at the time. And he just goes through the ringer. He starts as, well, like he says, like a kitchen slave, like doing, he has no experience in a professional kitchen. He was interested in cooking at home and would, you know, stage the, what he kind of describes as these awkwardly complicated, dinner parties for his friends, but no professional cooking experience. Starts as the low man, in the kitchen, eventually learns to work the grill station, work the pasta station, and then is so interested in the history of the food that they're preparing and also in Batali's backstory that he travels to Italy multiple times to learn pasta making and ultimately to apprentice as a butcher, in Tuscany, for, Dario Cecchini, who, yeah, that's the Dante quoting butcher, who is actually featured in a Chef's Table episode. I can't remember what season. But yeah, so that's that. And that's the arc of the book. It kind of, it jumps around a lot where he'll like be, describing his time, say in Babo, and then he'll jump back to a part of Mario Batali's career and then back to Babo and then back to the next stage in Batali's career. And he follows Batali, in this way from his early childhood. He spent part of his Like he's originally from Washington State somewhere, but his father was a Bombardier executive. And so he grew up, part of his youth was spent in Spain. Follows his childhood, his introduction to cooking professionally, working with, this is one of the weirdest parts of the, just, it's mind blowing. Like, I don't know how this happened because it was completely by chance, but Batali works for Marco Pierre White.
Right.
Early in White's career, like before White has Michelin stars and fame and fortune. So describe, like, that's a big part of the book, is just this weird chance encounter between two young men who go on to become very, very famous in their fields. Opening the restaurants in New York and Food Network and all this stuff. So,
do you, is there a mention in the book of like what, how Buford winds up at Babbo? Is that sort of by accident, or does he seek it out because he's interested in Batali, or does he seek it out because of some other reason?
He, the kind of initial incident, like the very first chapter of the book, is that, Bill Buford is hosting one of these dinner parties. He's cooking at home, and it's for a friend's birthday. And this friend, I guess, is very good friends with Mario Batali. And so Buford just had the idea of inviting Mario to the dinner. And that's how they met and how the journey started. So
I see.
It was, I don't know, I guess, how intentional that was, but that's how it's portrayed, is that he's like on a whim, asked his friend if Batali might want to come to the party.
Mm-hmm, on a whim. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess like if you're looking for a subject to write a book on, if both things, like you're looking to, you know, do like a immersive sort of like deep dive research by, you know, changing the course of your life and going to, and committing to like going to work in restaurants as the subject of a potential book that you want to write, you want to have a subject that is going to be compelling when you are, you know, when you get through to the end of that journey where you're, you know, ready to write about it or whatever.
I'm actually now remembering there is something, there's something like at the New Yorker, there's an idea that there should be a profile on Batali in the magazine. I can't remember, they shop around for writers and then Buford decides he should do it himself. There is something like that where it starts out as a profile for a magazine and then it gets so big that it becomes a book. But it is cool, like we've in our discussions about food movies, we've had some kind of like theoretical ideas for movies that could be great, that could be great food movies. Like for instance, that, like the Futurist Cookbook, like ideas from that becoming a movie, it would be so, it could be a great movie. The book Heat, or even like a biopic of Mario Batali, could be a fantastic movie. I don't know if it would be about, I don't know if you would call it a food movie or if it's like just a movie about a guy who happens to work with food, but like this arc, the time Batali, I didn't really realize this until I read Heat, but like the amount of partying and drug use and stuff that was part of Batali's life, or maybe still is, I have no idea. To have that element and then this rise to fame, the cradle of the Food Network, and then this really like ignominious fall, like with all of the sexual harassment cases, sounds like a great movie. I know it's not like, like in terms of
I don't know what you would, I don't know what the focus of that movie would, like the clearly the focus would have to be on, you know, his ignominious fall and how that destroyed people's lives, I'm sure, but
that would absolutely, like, that would obviously need to be a thematic thread through it, because but yeah, it's just so much of it is so over the top and sensational. Sorry, not the allegations. I just mean like the time, like to be that famous in New York at that time, at the beginning of the Food Network and all that, like it is a really, it's just, it's such a sensational story.
I like, it's so weird too, because like like the things that you're talking about, like the drug use and like the, you know, the sense of grandeur and all of that stuff, like all of that is like just this pre-existing condition of working in the food industry, kind of wherever you are. It's like, and I don't know, like it doesn't really go away, you know, like it, because I don't want to say anything like too ridiculously philosophical, but like there's kind of a, you know, because you're working around food and drink and these are like sort of this, it's sort of like this hedonistic kind of pursuit. Mm-hmm. And then, so I think that you get a lot of people working in the industry who are trying to satisfy that type of hedonistic desire. And then also like everyone who's in the industry is also busy trying to promote the value of like good food and mm-hmm. good drink to the people that they're trying to sell their services to all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the time, you know, that just inherently spills out into promoting it to the people that you're working with as well. Mm-hmm. And you can't help be exposed to that type of promotion and like that attitude. And so, you know, a lot of people and myself included early in my career, like really drank the Kool-Aid around that, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And like, luckily for me, I don't think that I, not that I didn't sometimes, have problems, making good decisions about what I should be eating or drinking or that type of thing. But luckily for me, it never like really led me down a road that I didn't think that it was possible for me to have some self-control or come back from.
Right.
But I know for a lot of people, that's not the case.
Yes.
You know, and I imagine that probably in a lot of ways for like, well, like for Bourdain, I guess he had some pre-existing problems before he was in the industry, but I'm sure being in the industry didn't help him solve those problems.
Right. Absolutely.
And then probably the same for Batali. And I hope it's very obvious that I'm not saying this to excuse Batali's behavior. Like that's a completely separate, disgusting thing that, you know, is, you know, obviously a part of his makeup. And like I said, I don't really know enough about it to comment on it, mm-hmm. but like the drug use and the, you know, like the wild nights and, you know, and then having being famous on the Food Network and the Food Network blowing up and probably having a whole bunch of money and probably his business blowing up at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like all of those things is just sort of like this, you know, it's like a, sort of a perfect storm of just like, oh, you know, I'm a rock star and I can do whatever I want, yeah. kind of egotistical sort of mayhem, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, that type of stuff is very difficult to like, I think, you know, pull yourself out of, because what motivation do you have to try and sort yourself out or clean yourself up when you basically have as many resources as you want and you can kind of do whatever you want and mm-hmm. get away with it. It's just,
there's some really interesting descriptions of where Batali, because of the fame, he needed to, and you can probably think of other examples of this in other celebrity chefs or just celebrities in general, where it became important for him to shock people in a way. Mm-hmm. To be provocative, and like a really small example, there's a description of an event where Batali and the chefs at Babo are invited to in Nashville, I think, to be guest chefs to serve a large group, like a few hundred people, some food, like some of their food. And there's some kind of, I don't know if it's an argument or some kind of conversation where a chef is insisting that the griddle is not hot enough. And Batali, who is in front of a whole bunch of Nashville chefs now in the kitchen, mm-hmm. says, of course it's hot enough. And he spits on the griddle to show that his spit sizzles. And everybody is just like, what did he just do? And Buford right. has a really great description of it, but and relates it to this, to the fame, and for it to be more important for people to see some kind of spectacle when he's there and walk away with that than to do whatever a normal chef would do in the situation.
Right.
Or descriptions of like,
it really reminds me of Bobby Flay standing up on the counter when he like won exactly. an Iron Chef battle.
Yes. Yeah. Like they start to think and operate along different lines of just like they have different rules that apply to them and they different ends that they're trying to achieve. And mm-hmm. there's descriptions of say when people start to recognize Batali in the street because of Food Network, the first few times people are like, oh man, we love your show. And Batali's just like very humble and grateful to them. Oh, thank you for watching. Yeah, it's a joy to make or whatever. But then he realizes that when he does that, people walk away disappointed. Like they don't feel like they met the celebrity. And so he started to like have these jokes or these like audacious things to say when people stopped him in the street that would just like give them that little, the taste of the guy from TV that they were expecting. I don't know. It's a really odd, right. Yeah, it's a really interesting look into celebrity.
Yeah. I mean, I remember really loving the book Heat when I read it, and I read it early in my career, and I don't exactly remember how I stumbled across it. Maybe it was recommended to me by someone who I was working with. I'm almost certain that it must have been. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm like hesitant to go back and read it because so much of the content is about Batali. Although I will say that when I was reading it, like I was interested in Batali at the time because of the Food Network. And so I was like, you know, reading that part of it was like compelling in a way because I was interested in Mario Batali. But I actually like found the last part of the book where he goes to Italy and works in the butchery, like even more fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe that's an example of like, or maybe that's, you know, my own, like where the information is more important than the presentation right. to me or something.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
If that's my bias, and that's why I found the Food Network to be boring when it turned to presentation over information, then maybe that's the reason why the last part of that book was the most interesting to me as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I really enjoyed his sojourn in the Tuscan butcher shop. I will say there's this weird element, maybe, you know, back to chefs becoming celebrities or meat cutters becoming celebrities. Mm-hmm. The way that Dario Cecchini is portrayed in the Chef's Table episode compared to how what you see of him in Heat was a pretty,
right.
pretty big discrepancy. And it really shines a light on how aggrandizing those Chef's Table episodes are.
Right. Man, that's like, really what they're shooting for. There's a few of those episodes where I just can't watch because I'm like, oh, this is
honestly
messed up.
It's I don't know if they're still making them, but like I did stop watching them because I was just like, this is silly. But
exactly.
the last chapter, the last sections of Heat have a much more realistic and fully fleshed portrait of him. He's also a to me, he's
was that a pun? Sorry. I just missed it.
No, not intentional. to me, honestly, Dario was also a problematic character. Like,
like I said, I have pretty vague recollections of it. So yeah,
but like,
and I think maybe it wasn't necessarily about the butcher; it was more about the butchery when I was reading it.
Right,
but
right,
yeah.
The stuff about meat is fantastic. What he is writing about in terms of how animals are raised and how they're processed and appreciated, like that, I love that part. But Dario is like, he is extremely narcissistic and a bully and a drunk. And
oh, interesting.
And one thing that that Buford talks about in the book that is not mentioned in the Chef's Table episode is that his meat is from Spain. The beef that he sells at his shop is from Spain. Not from Tuscany. It's not Chianina or whatever cows from Tuscany.
Sounds like a perfectly reasonable thing to me, but over there, I'm sure it's like if his customers found out, he would probably be drug out in the street
right.
shot.
Well, in terms of the way that he portrays his brand and his meat, it's shocking to some people. But
right.
Anyways, it's still a great, it's great writing, and it's a great, what, like I said, what it says about tradition and raising animals, killing animals is very important. But yeah, his, and honestly, I'm probably only bringing it up because of that Chef's Table episode, where it's like, there's such a, the difference in how he's portrayed is really striking.
Stark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Don't know if I'll go back and read it or not. We'll see.
It's a good book, and it's well, it's well written for sure.
Plus I have an entire Jonathan Gold book to read still, pretty much. I barely read any of it while I was away.
That makes sense. Why, how would you have time to do that?
I mean, I thought I was going to, like read some on the plane and read some on the train. And that maybe some days I'd be like sitting on the subway and I'd just pull out my, cause I put a copy on my phone so that I could read it wherever I was. And I really did think that that was something that I was going to do while I was in Japan. Cause I was like, cause I started reading it before I left and I was like, oh, this is like really, you know, inspiring in terms of like learning about food, and especially about, you know, like in terms of learning about food from another culture, like, you know, it really, like all of his stuff is like, or all of the stuff that I read at the beginning of the book is like all real deep dives into like really like niche cultural food stuff. And I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is going to be inspiring to read this while I'm in Japan and be able to have access to my own cultural food niche deep dives.
Yes. Yeah.
but yeah, it just didn't turn out that way. That I didn't have time. So it's, I guess you have a better idea of what my what's realistic for me.
It's funny, like I think I have this book a week kind of schedule written out, but Counterintelligence by Jonathan Gold is going to make me fall way off of my schedule, because I'm the kind of, we've kind of talked about this with my Soul of a Chef book, like the notes, like if I'm reading and like I see a word I don't know, like I stop and I look it up.
Right.
And usually that's not like a huge, it doesn't slow me up that much, but with Counterintelligence, every short, like the reviews are small. They're only two pages. But
like a few hundred words.
Within each one, there's a dozen words where I'm like, what is, like he describes, like if he's using a, describing a dish or an ingredient, like he'll tell you what it is, but I need to stop and write it down and be like, oh, like I'm going to follow up on this. Like,
right.
Cause he'll write about what, like a Cambodian restaurant. And I'm like, I don't know anything about Cambodian food. So there'll be 10 different words where I'm like, I need to remember this or I need to look into it. And so it's,
or, and even if you did know something about Cambodian food, like, you know, you might have like a couple, you might have a couple of dishes like surface level that you can think of that maybe you've tried or something, or, you know, but then like, you know, he winds up talking, like every restaurant that he goes to, he like tries to find the deepest corner of like cultural sort of authenticity that he can or something, and like really dig into it and figure out what, you know, like where it came from and stuff. And, and like, he doesn't put all of that into the review, but you can tell that that is there in, because of the way that he speaks about it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, and it's crazy.
The other thing about what I've read so far is that more so than any other food writing, and I've read a lot, more than any other food writing I've read, it makes me want to go out and eat.
Yeah.
Like, it, do you know what I mean? Like, I can sit and read Bourdain or Buford and be like, this is great. But like, I'm not, it doesn't have me like rushing out to try something in Edmonton. But the, honestly, I've probably, just reading the first 100 pages of Counterintelligence, like I've literally put the book down and gone out to buy a certain kind of food just from having read his description of it. Whether it's like a banh mi or sushi or whatever it is. Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I have a recommendation for you. I don't know if this will work for you or not, but like, I would say that probably in terms of Counterintelligence, you would be better off like rationing it over the course of the rest of the summer and still doing a book a week, but doing the other books and just like saying, okay, from, and also in each week I'll read like 10 sections or sent 10 reviews from Counterintelligence or something like that. Just because you, it could take you a month just to get through it if you're going to be thorough about it, you know.
Do you want, I know we have loads of content already. Do you want me to really quickly tell you about Letters to a Young Chef by Daniel Boulud?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. It sounds like, honestly, and because I haven't read it, it sounds like the kind of thing that I would want to talk more about at length. Mm-hmm. And so, I think probably when you're getting closer to the end of your reading journey, near the end of the summer, we should have another maybe book club episode. And maybe your description of it will inspire me to read it, and then maybe we can talk about it in a separate episode. But yeah, maybe give me like a quick breakdown of it and how it's going so far. You read the whole thing?
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's it's a pretty short read. And if anything, the edition that I bought seems like it's kind of been bulked out. Like they've added a bunch of, like, for instance, at the end, the last probably 20 or 30 pages is recipes, most of which have already been published in other Danielle books and stuff. But anyways, Letters to a Young Chef, it was recommended to me years and years ago. And it is that is the format. It's letters that Danielle is writing as kind of bits of advice for people who are starting out in the industry. And I would say on the whole, it's a little bit, I love Danielle Boulud, but it's a little bit quaint and paternalistic.
Okay.
It's a little bit like, this is what you need. Passion, loyalty, drive, dedication, like all of these kind of lofty words. Mm-hmm. To me, it reads a bit like a sermon.
Okay.
Whereas another book that young chefs should read, Soul of a Chef.
Right.
It actually shows you, it describes in vivid detail successful chefs who are displaying these characters.
Passionate.
Yeah, or, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's not just someone saying you should be passionate. It's showing the passion of real chefs. And so for my money, Soul of a Chef was way better. Granted, I'm reading Letters to a Young Chef when I'm 15 years into my career. So like maybe like I'm not the audience. So maybe it's not whatever. It doesn't matter what I think of it. But to me, the like sensuous reality and vivid descriptions in Soul of a Chef are much more moving than the words in Letters to a Young Chef. That being said, whatever, there's lots of cool little insights in the Boulud book. And even the ones that I wish there was more of, like he describes his own journey from, like, he grew up on a farm outside of Lyon, and he talks about some of the, like, the restaurants that he came up in, including notably like a 3-star Michelin restaurant in the French Riviera in the mid-70s, and the little tiny glimpses that he gives into the food that was served there are awesome. Like, it's just like a completely different era, a completely different world. I wish there was more of it. But on the whole, it's like a little bland to me.
A little philosophical and a little bland. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I may still give it a shot. We'll see.
I'll lend you a copy.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, there's a fair amount of stuff about Boulud in Bill Buford's book, Dirt. Mm-hmm. Boulud is kind of like a part of his journey to going to France to learn how to cook.
Right.
And yeah, so they have a few encounters. And yeah, I mean, it seems like, from like Bill Buford's description, it seems like Boulud is like a pretty generous, sort of generous with his time and also his
connections
and knowledge. Yeah. And yeah. And so I'm interested in reading more about Boulud. Mm-hmm. My impression of him from like some people that I've talked to who work from him, and also just from like looking at how big his like restaurant empire is that he's like pretty distanced from anything that's like hands-on, like real cooking or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like, I'm curious. I'd be curious to know what Boulud's life is like now. Like, does he choose where he wants to focus his actual like cooking energy and like, you know, is there like one or two restaurants where he actually goes and like is a part of like developing dishes and, mm-hmm. you know, has his hands in the food? Or is it just like he flies around and gives speeches? I just have no idea.
The one aspect of the book that did resonate with me, like having gone through the management side, is like the importance of building a team and hiring people, like hiring smart and trusting and relying on the people that you've hired, which of course, yeah, would obviously be essential for someone who's grown a business or businesses to as large as he has.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Do you know when the book was published?
I know that in the introduction to the one that I read, he said it's been 15 years since the original publication, but I can look really quick. Originally published 2003, and the edition the edition I was reading is from 2017.
Man, a lot of like books about chefs and cooking published in the mid 2000s.
Yeah, well, there, Shale, it was an interesting time. There was a little food renaissance, and there was,
you might call it the golden era.
I might, yeah. And interestingly, not just chefs writing, but like we were talking about how like Buford is someone from, like he's a man of letters who decided to write about food. That was a big thing at that time too. There was like really famous authors who were swept up in the food renaissance. And so you had people like Jonathan Safran Foer, who's like an award, like he wrote Everything is Illuminated and The Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. He wrote a book about food called Eating Animals. And Barbara Kingsolver, like a famous author of the Poisonwood Bible, she wrote a book on food and it is 100% escaping me right now. Animal, vegetable, I can't remember. Anyways, yeah, you had like lots of famous authors deciding to write about food. And so it made for good writing and yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, made for good podcast discussion fodder.
Yeah.
In retrospect.
Yes. Little did they know they were planting the seed 20 years hence, two dudes.
Yeah, two dudes talking. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.